From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Daylight savings time is behind us and spring is almost here. To celebrate, we're reflecting on a venerable example of local fauna. The Quercus virginiana is Georgia's official tree. It's better known as the live oak tree and has held that title since 1937. These majestic, ancient trees are symbols of the South in postcards, films, and online travel sites. We invited Greg Levine from Trees Atlanta to tell us more about the nature and history of the live oak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to have you with us. How would you, Greg, describe the live oak to someone who's never seen one?
Well, the live oak is a tree that you often see on the coast of Georgia and some of the southern states, and it has long, sprawling branches. It's evergreen, so it keeps its leaves all year long, and you often will see the Spanish moss hanging from the tree, and the branches can spread almost 120 feet.
Wow.
So they're massively broad trees.
And it's been the state tree for more than 8 decades. Is this a permanent designation?
Yeah, I would say it's permanent designation. I think there'd be a lot of challenges if somebody tried to change the live oak from our state tree.
So does this happen each? How often do they update this?
I don't think they've ever updated it. I think it's been the only
it's just
state
like
tree.
It's a given.
Yep.
So what goes into that kind of decision making? Do we even know?
You know, I don't really know how they came up with it, but I do believe that it is iconic of the state. I think it's a tree that you can identify from any other tree, because obviously it's evergreen, but it has such a specific look that it's a graphic that you see all over the place, mm-hmm. the live oak. And I think it's how most states pick a specific state tree.
Where does that name live oak come from?
Wow, that's a good question.
I'm so sorry I'm throwing all these big questions at you. All right, how about this? What's the difference between a live oak and other oaks?
That's a really good question. So, of course, genus, species is something you might learn in botany or biology. All oak trees are the Quercus genus, and a live oak is virginiana. So there are actually 33 native oak trees to Georgia. So live oak is one of the 33 native oaks to Georgia. In fact, we have the second most oak species of any state in the country.
Mm-hmm. That was my next question. Is it native? But was there a role for it in Native American life, for example?
A lot of oak trees had a role in Native American life. The acorns are actually edible. Maybe don't taste that good, but they actually pounded the acorns into flour, and they would actually cook it and eat acorn, like an acorn almost bread.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, chestnut was much more tasty, so acorns were more on a kind of when you're a little desperate for something to eat, I guess.
I don't necessarily think of acorns in that case, but let's see. They do look like these ancient, almost prehistoric trees. How long can they live?
Actually, live oaks have records of, I think, 400 years. A lot of our oak trees can live about 400 to 600 years old. And our white oak, which is another great oak tree, also probably lives about 600 to 800 years. They can live that long.
Wow. Why is it so significant in Georgia historically, the live oak?
Well, I think it's a tree that was associated with old, historic homes and, the big farms that we had mm-hmm. in the South. So I think that it was something, even with Gone with the Wind, frankly. I mean, Gone with the Wind, they kind of used that live oak look as a tree that was a setting for the movie set. So I think it's just something that people have associated with the South. I don't really...
But what was it used for? Was it used for any particular thing?
No, I mean, they do...
Shipbuilding, houses, anything?
Shipbuilding was a big piece of mm-hmm. it. Shipbuilding, because it was on the coast. But as far as, lumber-wise, yes, they use it for construction, but shipbuilding was a big piece of it, again, because it was easily accessible to the ocean. But other than that, it's nothing more specific than most other oak.
So are they still harvested or grown? I mean, do people grow live oak trees as begin them now?
Yeah, mostly people grow live oaks for the beauty and the aesthetic component of it. Usually timber, they look for faster growing trees, such as pine. So pine, you see a lot of pine farms. I don't believe that people are growing live oak for actually harvesting, and although I'm sure it is harvested some.
How did these trees contribute to the local ecosystem?
They're obviously oak trees, and all trees are the major part of any ecosystem in Georgia. It's the largest, green part of it, the largest plant. And oak trees actually are the most important tree for caterpillar species. Actually, 500 different caterpillar species will actually eat the leaves of oak trees. So more than any other tree in the state. And of course, caterpillars feed about 80% of the baby birds, fledgling birds' diet. So without oak trees, we lose a lot of our birds. In fact, there's a recent study that says native plants in general, native plants, once you drop below 70% of native plants in your landscape, the bird population drops. And a lot of it is centered around the bugs that eat those plants that feed the birds.
Well, so your organization has worked a lot to preserve the tree canopy. And Georgia has had a lot of development and construction, especially in Atlanta. How does development affect these live oaks?
Well, so all across Georgia, we're obviously having a lot of people move from up north. I think you might be one of them.
I'm one of the people who's ruining it.
Yes. So a lot of people are moving to Georgia, and so quickly that a lot of our ordinance and zoning has not really been able to save the canopy. It's with good intentions, but not quite the right ordinances. So we're having a lot of new construction, and we're trying to figure out ways that we can bring double the population in the next 20 years without losing our canopy. We'd like to actually keep Atlanta's canopy at 50%. So it's a balancing act, and right now it's not quite balanced, but the city is working very hard to make sure that we are able to do that. And that means that ordinance is going to have to change, but we also should be buying more forested land in the city as well. And of course, plant more trees. So it's, you know, kind of a three-pronged fork.
I'm speaking with Greg Levine. He's co-executive director of Trees Atlanta. And spring is almost here, and we're discussing the nature of the live oak tree, the state's official tree, and other trees. Tree canopy is a big part of what his organization is working to preserve. But, you know, like if you're thinking about development, a big, huge, sprawling oak tree, it may not be the one that you're going to choose. What is their root system like? Is that something that messes up, you know, like as their aggressive roots spread, do they ruin foundations, crack through sidewalks, that kind of thing?
I mean, trees probably, normally you want to get a big, large shade tree, a tree that gets over 60 or 80 feet, about 20 feet at least away from your foundation. But I can tell you I've had two houses that had trees within 3 feet of the foundation, and house doing quite well. I wouldn't have planted it, but they were there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, tree roots do spread about at least as wide as the actual branches. So you can imagine that a tree with an 80-foot spread, the roots are probably spreading 80 feet as well. But right tree, right place, you should be able to plant a shade tree pretty close to your house and not have a problem.
And this strong root system is one of the things that makes them supposedly hurricane-proof or disaster-proof, but that wasn't the case when the Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans in 2005. Has Georgia experienced damage from Hurricane Michael and beforehand? What's the status of oak trees in the state since the storm?
Well, we've lost a lot of trees through the last couple of hurricanes, and the live oaks are pretty durable and tend to stay up more than almost any other tree, but a lot of them have come down. And I know there are efforts to replant a lot of trees in South Georgia. I know that Savannah has lost a number of live oaks as well, and both from storm and from basically the trees aging out.
Mm-hmm.
But trees tend to fall mostly during the strongest storms and are pretty durable otherwise.
How important are they when we're talking about climate change? Can preserving this historic Georgia tree and others, younger ones, actually help reduce carbon emissions?
Well, trees are a great carbon sink, meaning they absorb carbon when they're growing and they can put it back into the ground. It's really important to have a great forest cover. And over the entire country and world, we are losing forest cover. So individuals that don't have a lot of shade or canopy should think about planting a tree, and specifically an oak tree would probably be the most important. It doesn't have to be a live oak, though. You can plant one of the other 32.
You're partnering with other nonprofits to present a series of talks across the city aimed at updating this tree ordinance that you mentioned before to talk about protecting the dwindling tree canopy in Atlanta. And of course, oftentimes there's whether it's genuine or not, there it's like development versus the environment. So what kind of case are you making to developers and city planners and those who are in charge making these kind of decisions that the tree canopy is important here.
Sure. Well, so we're kind of having a call to action and supporting the city. The city is trying to rewrite the ordinance right now, and we want to support the city in the rewriting of it to protect more canopy. I think if you're looking in from a developer's perspective, if you want people to continue to move in Atlanta and stay in Atlanta and bring revenue and resources to the city, you have to have a great quality of life. And as we lose our tree canopy, that is what makes Atlanta special. And people aren't going to want to move here as much as if we lose our canopy. Plus, we have more water issues, which means we have more flooding. Our sewers get overloaded, which basically increases the need for increasing taxes because we have to build better sewer systems and bigger sewer systems. And of course, there's air quality and asthma and other health issues without our tree canopy, which means we have more hospital bills and people missing work more. So to be a healthy and economically viable city, we need to keep this asset and we need to keep it at where it's at, not lose any more of it. And it goes beyond Atlanta. We need to start looking at it in a regionally way as well. So those 13 growing counties need to figure out ways to keep their canopy as well.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, you go to places like Savannah and every calendar, every book, you know, it has pictures of these beautiful, beautiful live oak trees. Do you think people think about trees in the same way that they're thinking about, you know, preserving historic architecture, for example?
Yeah, you know, I think maybe more people think about trees because it connects them to the wildlife component that so many of us hold so dear. And there is a connection towards health. So I think there's actually a greater connection than even historical architecture, which is also very important. I think they almost fit in the same thing. It's actually looking at what makes a place healthier and better and more interesting and have depth of layers of history. When you have all that, you know, whether it's a building or a forest, it brings something special to your community. And in the end, if we don't have that, then what makes Atlanta or Georgia different than any other place?
I'm thinking about you. You said something about Gone with the Wind, and whether it's true or not, I imagine like that in the film To Kill a Mockingbird, Scout sitting up in a, you know, they're great climbing trees,
yes,
the live oak tree, sitting up in a tree. But the film's like, you know, from Gone with the Wind to 12 Years a Slave. And it is interesting that the designation as the state tree was made in 1937. This was at a time when Georgia was very keen on communicating southernness.
Yeah.
Do you think there's any connection there?
Oh, sure there is. I think, but also probably to the past as well, which, you know, there's some obviously things that we want to be connected to the past, but trees are not, you know, trees only do good. I mean, they're only making Atlanta and Georgia better, and we need to figure out ways to live with them. And we can figure out ways to double this population in Atlanta, which is what they're predicting, and still keeping the forest canopy. And I think that it's not going to be just Atlanta, but it's going to be places like Savannah and, you know, to Birmingham and Alabama, where these cities continue to grow. We've got to balance this out.
Greg Levine, he's co-executive director of Trees Atlanta. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Now, Greg and his organization is partnering with other nonprofits to present a series of talks in places all across the city. We can find that more online. Some details on that, gpbnews.org. When was the last time you listened to someone tell a good story? Well, get your ears ready. We're going to speak with Andy Irwin, one of the featured speakers from this year's Big Fibbers Storytelling Festival in Rome, and Glenn Washington, host of Snap Judgment. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us for more of On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Glenn Washington is host of Snap Judgment, which you can hear Saturday afternoons at 1 on GPB. Glenn and his team present a live show of storytelling with a beat at Atlanta Symphony Hall later this month. My colleague Leah Fleming spoke with Glenn and asked him about his own story, which began as a kid growing up in a cult called the Worldwide Church of God.
It was an apocalyptic end of days organization that was founded by a former ad man. His name was Herbert W. Armstrong. And we thought that the end of days was coming any minute and we had to get right and do exactly what we were told, lest we were going to get left behind. I was a true believer as a kid. And it wasn't until much, much later, until my late teens, that I decided that I'd take a step out and leave the organization. And when I did, even when I did that, I thought, you know, fire was going to come down from heaven, that there was a part of me that still was in it even as I was walking out.
Have you found a way to be spiritual today?
I think that everyone has their own aspect of the divine. And the closest thing to telepathy, the closest thing we can to getting in someone else's head is narrative, it's storytelling. I don't have a specific spiritual practice except to say that I truly do believe that storytelling helps us connect with each other's divinity.
I wanted to ask you something about mental illness, and that is something that we have covered quite a bit on my show, because I have a passion for that, particularly when it comes to mental illness and people of color. I know that this is something that has touched your life personally, and I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that.
I sure can. As you mentioned, it's touched me in a lot of different ways. Actually, I feel particularly fortunate personally, because mental illness does run in my family, particularly depression, but we've had schizoaffective disorder, schizophrenia itself, which are these horrible, debilitating diseases that strike people in their prime. My grandmother called him my twin, actually my brother, who was 1 year younger than me. And he was 1 year younger, a lot smarter. We both ended up going to school in Japan, and he was a bond trader in Tokyo. Top of the world, top of his game, making things happen, a model on the side, and then started hearing voices. You know, again, because of, you know, the religious nature of my family, it's not odd to speak to God or have God talk back to you in my family. And I think I didn't realize what was happening until later on, when he was debilitated and gone from the top of the world to chasing dumpsters for food and not even in a place to be able to receive help. Like, can I take you, brother? Just come with me, brother. Come with me. Just get in the car, bro. Just get in the car. I'm going to take you somewhere. And not having him even be able to respond that look. And it haunts me even when I'm talking to you about it right now. I feel like we were robbed of him. And I know that that loss has colored a lot of the storytelling that happens on Snap. Because I think a lot of storytelling really is about dealing with ghosts and chasing ghosts. And that has certainly been a lot of energy behind my own personal storytelling.
And have you made sure to take care of your own mental health? Because I know that this is really an issue for all people, but particularly African Americans, where we grew up with a stigma of not to talk about it to God, but not to other people.
Right. Tell Jesus. But don't tell anybody else. Yeah, that's a problem in our community. And we're conditioned, number one, you have to be hyper-masculine on a male side, and on the female side. You know, the black women's got to carry everything. Strong black woman. You can't have no cracks, no nothing in that facade. And yet that's, you know, certainly the way I was raised. This is what's so amazing about storytelling in general. It's this thing where, you know, a lot of us have these various skeletons in our closet. And I know, and I got more than most. And if you talk to someone on the street and you say, what is your story? What is your story? Tell me your story. 9 times out of 10, that person's going to tell you a story of trauma. And that trauma is going to stop at the most horrific aspect of what was going on in their young lives. the story could stop with me crying as a 10-year-old in some closet with someone shouting on the other end of it. The story could stop there. But with storytelling, I get to take little Glenn, take myself, and end that story wherever I want to. I can end it in a position of strength and of power and of love and of acceptance and of joy. And when I tell this story, when I tell my own story that way, I change myself. I change the way I see my past and I change the way I am. It's such a power to be able to seize back your own story from the monsters. I'll be forever grateful for that.
That's Glenn Washington speaking with Morning Edition host Leah Fleming. Snap Judgment airs on Saturdays at 1 on GPB. And you can see the show live on March 30th at Atlanta Symphony Hall. Details are at our website, gpbnews.org. Truth never gets in the way of a good story at the Big Fibbers Storytelling Festival. This weekend, comedians, fabulists, and tellers of tall tales from all over will gather in Rome, Georgia. Among the unreliable narrators is comedian and storyteller Andy Offutt Irwin. Andy's been featured at the festival for nearly a dozen times, and he's joining me on the line. Hello, Andy.
Hi, how are you, Virginia?
I'm just fine. For those who don't know already, what is the Big Fibbers Festival?
It's a storytelling festival in Rome, Georgia. It's on the national circuit of storytelling festivals all over the United States. And right now, as I speak, I'm in an elementary school here near Rome, and I'm in between sets. So we're busy. We've been doing four kids shows a day from Monday through Thursday, and the grown-ups show up on Friday through Sunday. So we're working hard, man.
So you call them sets there at the heart, that tough elementary school circuit? Is that where you're working?
Yes. We generally in festivals, we will work a lot of schools or school children before the grown-ups show up on the weekend. So I've come to terms with the fact that most of my audience is forced to watch me.
Captive audience, never a bad thing.
Indeed.
So, but why do they call it the Big Fibbers Festival? Is everyone lying in these stories and they're competing for the best lie?
No, there's a competition. There's a big Fibbers competition, and I don't know the schedule. I just show up. The national acts this year are a fellow named Bill Lepp from West Virginia. Bill is actually my best buddy on the road. We work together a lot. And I am, of course, from Covington, Georgia. And Bill and I are both fiction writers. And the Big Fibbers name came from a woman named Debbie Brown. And 10 years ago or so, she put together a festival with a Cherokee Celtic combination.
Okay.
And she called it Big Fibbers Festival. So, you know, when we tell our stories, most of us are allowed to tell fiction, and when people are listening, they like to sometimes call it a lie or a fib. She wanted to call it Big Liars Festival, Debbie, but her mama would not let her say lies, so she said fibbers. So that's what they call it here.
So what makes for a good lie in a story? I mean, like, how do you get people to believe a lie?
You start small and you move larger. You have to create a place that people see it in their minds. In storytelling, it's a sort of a form of theater. And I know you were just talking about Glenn Washington, Glenn Washington. I was listening in on that. Most of those stories are true, but a fiction tale has to have truth. And of course, truth is I'm not talking about facts. I'm talking about a greater truth. I create a character named Marguerite Van Camp. Marguerite is 85 years old and just graduated from medical school. And so saying, you should know right at the get-go that that's fictional. But then when I start doing her voice, people start believing her. And that's when a fib works. Marguerite says stuff like, well, my husband Charles, when he passed away, we both had a his and hers tombstone with both our names on it. That's a better value. And I start that way, and then she can talk about whatever she wants to, sort of like a ventriloquist dummy. I maintain innocence, and Marguerite can say anything.
So it's sort of like a con, like you have to get people to believe you enough to be able to deliver the fiction.
Right. It's so much like if you're reading a novel and you become engaged in the characters, then you believe in the characters. And if the author doesn't believe in the characters, the reader won't believe in the characters. We're doing a very similar thing, but we're trying to bring the pictures to the collective audience and perform those characters from stage.
How did you learn how to lie?
I was that kid that when I saw something interesting in the world, I would go home and tell my mom about it, but I would exaggerate it, and she let me get away with it because it was so much more interesting than what was just happening. So that's kind of it. That's how I learned to be a fiction writer.
Well, you also, so now you're talking to kids in school. I mean, kids know how to lie, like you just said. We love to exaggerate. We love to entertain. But how do you get them interested in storytelling? How do you capture their attention?
I never stopped working with children ever since I was a child. I like to tell people, I was a camp counselor at 19 years old. So I was a kid when I started working with kids, and I never stopped. My rule in life is to treat children with the respect that I give grown-ups and to treat grown-ups with the exuberance that children crave. Mm. The kids know if you're talking down to them, and they know if you're on their side. If I ever make fun of, if I see a teacher in the back, for example, I have a character named Miss Shirley. Miss Shirley was my preschool teacher, and I'll say, "Do you think it's appropriate for you to be on the phone in front of the young people? They're looking to you for guidance." And the kids know that you're on their side. It's not very hard. I'm just sort of a clownish guy when it comes with kids. And then, you know, I have a song called The Jelly Song, and I have to, you know, some people like grape jelly, some people like apple jelly, but the kind of jelly that I want in my belly is petroleum jelly. And I explain, you know, how it's, you know, anyway, it's hard to explain. But, yeah, they just trust you. You know, kids know if people are authentic. Mm. That was Fred Rogers' secret. He was authentic. He was the same with children as he was with adults, and that's one of the secrets. I'm no Fred Rogers because I'm a silly guy, but kids know authenticity just like that. They know it quickly.
Well, this is a family festival event. Children, adults, seniors. Are the stories all G-rated for the most part?
I would say yes. When I say grown-up entertainment, it's not adult entertainment. Marguerite was driving one day with my son, and there was a billboard that said adult supplies, and she covered his eyes. And for 5 years, he thought the word adult was a dirty word. So grown-ups, you know, I think that grown-ups should be, when we say family entertainment, we're not just talking about kids' entertainment. We're talking about everybody in the room can understand it. And if the kids don't understand the details of what I'm saying, it's only because they're not grown-ups. You know, adults understand things that kids don't. But yes, it's G-rated. I would say that, yes.
How much of your storytelling is improv and how much is scripted? You just pulled a couple of characters up just there.
Well, it's mostly scripted, and then my job is to make it look extemporaneous as mm-hmm. I go. But my stuff is scripted, yes, indeed. It's fairly kind of complicated and convoluted with Marguerite. I write in terms of a joke, you know, just like all comedians. I have a joke, but my jokes are long-form narratives, so the setup might be 20 minutes before the payoff. And that's the difference between storytelling, say, or fictional storytelling and stand-up. I'm not counting laughs per minute. I'm trying to build a bigger idea. And actually, I try to be I'd like to say my humor has work to do. It might have some social work to do. It might have some environmental work to do without hammering or preaching too hard at people. So that's part of what the humor's for.
Andy Offutt Irwin is my guest. He's one of the fibbers at this year's Big Fibber Storytelling Festival in Rome this weekend. Andy, do you know that game, Two Truths and a Lie?
Yes. They told me that you might be wanting to play that. Yes.
Well, I just thought if I had a liar here, you know, for listeners who don't know about it, the game involves a good liar telling two things that are true and one that's a lie. And you have to try and figure it out. So have you got it? You got any up your sleeve here?
Well, as soon as I got off the phone with your producer, I went and did a show and came back. Well, my husband's tombstone, anyway, it has my name on it and his name on it and the year he was born and the year he died. And my name on it and the year I was born. And then there's a 19 on my tombstone. My tombstone's got the Y2K.
All right, that's a lie.
No, well, I told Andy it's not. He said it's not like it's etched in.
Anyway, but yes, that's a lie. So Marguerite is not true, but I do have a grandmother who's named Sally Mae Cook, whose voice is Marguerite's. And I am sixth generation Newton County. That's, if you saw me, that's why my head is so small.
I'm going to believe that.
You should, yes. I'm not good at that game, I'll confess.
Well, you do have a pretty long background in storytelling. The festival is in Rome is now in its fifth year. So right. Is it a different routine each time? We've got about 30 seconds, so you're on the clock now.
Every set will be different for everything that we do.
Andy Offutt Irwin, thank you so much for lying with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Virginia. It's been a pleasure.
And telling us a couple truths. He's featured at this year's Big Fibbers Storytelling Festival. The event starts on Friday in Rome, Georgia. Details at our website, gpbnews.org. Coming up, saving lives by teaching kids to swim. I'm Virginia Prescott. We're going to meet the CEO and founder of Swim Kids. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Drowning is one of the three top causes of unintentional deaths for people under the age of 29. The CDC reports that African American children between ages of 5 and 14 are three times as likely to die from drowning than white children. A near-drowning experience led Trish Miller to create Swim Kids. It's a nonprofit that helps kids and their families learn how to swim and be safe in the water. She's speaking at TEDx Atlanta later this week and joins me now in the studio. Trish, welcome.
Thank you, Virginia. I'm so glad to be here.
Did you swim growing up?
I cannot say that I did. I grew up at the oceanfront, though, which is...
What?
That's what makes it so funny, is that I grew up at the oceanfront. We never went to the beach. I've never even seen my mother in a bathing suit. So that should tell you we were not water people whatsoever. So I actually did not experience water until much later in life.
Mm.
So no,
so
did not swim.
That's interesting. I mean, I've certainly heard a lot of African American comedians making jokes about, mm-hmm. you know, we didn't swim. We don't swim. So was that a thing in your family? Was that something that you shared with other people of your generation?
It's absolutely cultural. It's one of those things where historical events really contributed to it. And if you really look at the studies and the data that supports that, Jim Crow and segregation actually had a lot to do with Black people having access to pools. So it became a situation of where we just didn't have the knowledge to pass down to our children, and it became, it's not for us. And it actually resulted in the numbers that we experience today in terms of drowning rates of our children.
And for you personally, you had a near drowning experience. This was as a teenager. What happened?
Yeah, I actually was on spring break with a group of friends. We decided to go to a beach, not uncomfortable. Common when you're in college, and we wanted to go to the swimming pool. It was too cold out to get into to splash around in the ocean. So we went to the pool, and my friends, just like most people, when you say that you don't know how to swim, they're going to teach you. It's so easy. All you have to do is. And they spent just a little bit of time teaching me how to swim, teaching me so-called the basics. And I was 19 and did not know any better, and felt they, with their encouragement, oh, you're ready, you got it, you're good. And I jumped in the deep end, 12 feet of water, felt like I was fine, and I was fine the first time I came up, kind of fine the second time I came up. But then when I couldn't stay up, that's when I panicked.
Yeah.
I did not learn how to tread water. And I lost it. And so my friends actually had to come and get me because I sank and was drowning. It was the most scariest thing, though that was decades ago. Never will forget that feeling. Mm. And I never wanted my children or anyone else to experience that just because of lack of resources or just really lack of awareness of how important this is for you to learn as a child.
Now, you were 19 years old then. Mm-hmm. Did you not go in the water for a long time?
Oh, it was. I took a very long break. I took a very long break from the water after that. I'm still friends with those group of friends today, and we were just talking about it while I was preparing for this talk. And it really wasn't until my mid to late 30s that I jumped back into the water and said, I'm going to conquer this thing and learn how to swim. So it's never too late to learn how to swim. What the data shows us, and certainly what I've learned working in public health, is we tend to think about swimming as this recreational thing. So because we feel it's recreational, we don't prioritize it, especially as the Black community. We don't tend to prioritize it. We prioritize sports. And it is a large generalization that I'm making. But however, on a whole, we tend to prioritize sports and other things rather than swimming. We don't see that as something that, well, we can protect our children from it. We'll just keep them from the water. And it's a life-saving skill that we need to learn, and we need to make sure that our children learn young. And then as adults, we need to make sure that we know, because there's a recent movement, though, of people being more aware of those statistics. So they are putting their children into swimming programs maybe once or twice, but then they don't know how to swim. So if their children ever get into trouble, right, they're not breeding strong swimmers. Mm-hmm. So if their children get into trouble in the water, they can't save them. And so it still becomes an issue of a drowning risk for their families, because the full family doesn't have that knowledge and life-saving skill that's needed to protect them.
And this is why you started Swim Kids. Tell me how that happened. How did that evolve, that you realized like something you needed to do?
Yeah, thank you so much for asking about that. Swim Kids is a school-based program. It's designed after models in other states. So Minnesota and Virginia, for example, are states that make it a priority for children to learn while they're in the school system. It's a part of the school's curriculum. So it's one less thing that parents have to do either in evenings or on the weekends. And the children learn those introductory water safety and swimming skills during the school day. And then the parents can elect to continue them on. And they can then also, those schools typically have access to a pool where the children can continue in camps and things like that. So they not only are introduced, they become proficient swimmers. Mm-hmm. Swim Kids takes a similar model and similar approach, where we work with elementary and middle school students to introduce them to introductory lessons. But then we take a holistic approach with the family and allow the family to also be able to take lessons, whether it's on site at their homes and at their home pools, or at our pools where we actually offer the lessons for the family.
Okay, so do a lot of schools in Georgia have pools or access to pools?
So there are tons of pools in Georgia. They just need to be used.
Mm-hmm. So you mean you're even using like family pools, people's home pools for this kind of thing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So our pilot, though, is with a middle school that has a pool on site, which is almost unheard of. And we are employing a model where this particular middle school will serve as a hub for the elementary schools that are within its cluster, so that we can ensure that at least those elementary schools and students will be introduced to swimming before they get to the middle school program, and then they will continue on once they're at middle school.
Okay, so you're talking about working with school systems, individual schools, insurance. I mean, how did you do this?
So I am Wonder Woman, Virginia. Did you not recognize that?
I didn't see the outfit under your nice professional sweater. And
I'm not doing it alone by any stretch. I have a great team of certified swimmers that are very familiar with timid young swimmers, children, families. They are African-American trainers. And so we've also recognize that typically there's a trust factor that we have to acknowledge and we have to say up front that makes it easier for people to learn how to swim in something that's so scary. Water is scary for many people. And so you have to be able to trust that person. And many times you trust the person that kind of looks like you. That's just what we've noticed. So our trainers are certified. They go to these schools. We actually pilot in the spring with these two schools, and we will just offer these lessons and hopefully change and turn around this statistic of drowning in our state.
Yeah, let's look at those statistics for drowning mm-hmm. in the state. So first of all, overall, 2017, Georgia was fifth in the nation for children drowning in
Absolutely.
Pools. This is the Consumer Product Safety Commission came up with those numbers. What is it specific to Georgia, you think, that makes it so high?
Yeah, the only thing that I can attribute it to is just the lack of awareness. We just don't have the knowledge. And we that number is actually second in terms of child drownings in Georgia, it's second only to Florida,
mm-hmm.
Which is at an oceanfront. So the only thing I can attribute it to is just the lack of awareness and that we need to expose our children young, which is why these school-based programs are so essential to teach them before they get the fear, before those kind of things come up to them, where they become like a fish. They just become very used to that type of environment. And they can then influence and change those pictures for their families, too.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, the family thing is really interesting to me because, you know, it's like you said, you can teach kids
yeah.
almost anything. But once somebody has been enculturated all their mm-hmm. life to be fearful of water, how do you get over that hoop? And, you know, there's the embarrassment of I'm an adult and I don't know how to swim.
There's all of that, Virginia. You hit it right on the head. What has been helpful for us is recently there have been celebrities that have come forth saying that they in their 40s are learning how to swim. And they have acknowledged how important it is and that it really is something that you need to learn no matter what age. And especially if you have children, that it's something that you need to prioritize. So dealing with that embarrassment is one thing, but knowing how it affects the drowning rates is another. You gave some statistics, but one more I want to just really make sure we hear is that Black middle school students actually drown at a rate 10 times that of whites.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's your 11 and 12-year-olds primarily drown 10 times. And again, that has everything to do with awareness and access to pools. It's not cost. Cost typically is a factor. But in terms of sports and other things that we pay for, swimming lessons pale in the cost factor. So it really is prioritization and awareness.
Trish Miller is with me. She's the founder of Swim Kids, which is teaching kids and their families about water safety, trying to make a dent in the pretty dismal statistics about mm-hmm. how many kids drown, as we just heard. 11 to 12-year-olds, especially at these ages, blacks drown in swimming pools 10 times the rate of whites. What, is it swimming pools primarily where people drown rather than in lakes? I mean, you think if you grow up in the country, maybe, or well, you've just...
Yes, I grew up in the country.
You just completely countered that. You know, because for me, you know, it was like a rite of passage. You learn
yeah.
how to swim when you're a little kid.
Yeah.
And that obviously didn't happen. I'm, you know, white woman from New England. We
right.
had a place by the lake kind
mm-hmm.
of thing. So there is, you know, how did... So obviously class,
yep.
race play into this because I'm also looking for, you know, among Hispanic kids, Latinx,
mm-hmm.
Native Americans, Alaska Natives, twice the rate for whites. This is my own cluelessness, never
mm-hmm.
thought that swimming is just a white thing.
Yeah. I mean, it really is. I want to add one more dynamic that we don't really talk about in terms of Black females and them learning how to swim. So there's another obstacle, especially with younger Black girls, and that is hair.
Oh, right.
And we typically have thick, curly hair that we don't want to style every day in that way. So in terms of if it gets wet, it takes time to fix it back up. So I've had so many mothers and children that would come to me and say, you know, and I actually experienced it myself. My daughter, who is a great swimmer, wanted to be on her school swim team. It's a great activity for her. But I had to tell her no, because I could not keep up with maintaining her
mm-hmm.
hair.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very real thing that if she got in the pool earlier that day, what was she going to do for the rest of the day? It wasn't a situation where she could just put it in a ponytail or she could just rinse it in the swimming pool, or I mean, in the shower or something like that. It was a real consideration. And the currently designed swimming caps are not designed for the volume of hair that thick curly hair typically is, nor is it designed to keep the hair dry. And since it doesn't work to keep the hair dry, it actually prohibits or is one of the prohibitors to a lot of Black females, especially getting in the water.
Okay. So another aspect of white default or white privilege that, you know,
indeed.
Don't think about that kind of thing.
Yeah,
so
indeed.
Great business opportunity for somebody to do swimming caps for for young Black women.
Absolutely. And fortunately, I'm actually in a fellowship that is supporting my business in creating and developing that first waterproof swimming cap.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you talked a little bit about what you're doing inside of schools,
mm-hmm.
right? Working to pilot the program in Atlanta Public Schools.
Mm-hmm.
How have school administrators responded to this?
Oh, they have been thrilled. They have just been absolutely thrilled because they don't have the resources. And even one of the schools that has a pool on site doesn't have the resource to make sure that the children are actually learning. And as a result, it doesn't get used very much.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful Olympic-sized pool that most of the children don't know how to swim, so they're not using it. Not at the rate that you would think that they would. So they're not able to have a very robust swimming program or a swim team or something like that just because the children don't have the knowledge. So I've not approached one school that has said, no, this is not a priority for us. The drowning rates speak, and you can't deny, especially schools that are within our metro area and our inner city area or more urban areas who are predominantly Black, we can't deny what those rates are and that we each play an important part in making sure that we change that. And if the way to change that is to introduce them to the water and give them the skills that they need, we got to do that. It's very, very common and similar to anything else that we would give our children skills to do. We teach them to put their seatbelts on. We teach them to put on pads when they go outside and helmets. We want to protect them. This is one more way we can protect them.
So where do you see this going? You have an MBA, is that correct?
I do, and an MPH.
And in public health. Is this
mm-hmm.
Do you have a day job now, or is this what you're doing? This is it, Swim Kids.
I also have a day job where I work in public health with
so
the
you
CDC
are
Foundation.
Wonder Woman.
I'm going to save the world and work at the same time. I love this mission. I love this mission and would love for this to be something that we can focus on full time.
Mm-hmm.
And the more schools that we get involved, the more support that we get from our communities and our leadership, that will be a reality. We have a goal of reaching next academic year 500 to 1,000 children. And we can't do that without the support. We've gotten a lot of great support, though. And even with this TEDx Talks coming up on Friday, that's one way that is allowing us to get the word out and get the message out and shine a light on what this issue is and to just garner even more support around just changing these numbers.
Yeah, so what do you want folks to walk away with? What do you want them to hear when you speak to them at the TEDx talk?
Thank you. I want them to hear that they need to pay attention and they need to prioritize it. So it's not enough to say, oh, poor little Black kids. We need to prioritize it. This is a public health crisis that is not something that we see or hear about very often. And even when you were reading those statistics, I believe a lot of those were even shocking to you because it's not something that's widely publicized. And we tend to think about swimming as something that we do in the summertime. So summer comes around and now we want to give our kids lessons. Well, it's kind of too late then. So they're already exposed to the water. They're exposed to parties and splash parks with their friends. Really, we have to teach them. Unfortunately, in the wintertime, when it's cold, that's when we really should be introducing them to water, fall and wintertime, to get them ready for the summer.
Trish Miller, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Virginia.
And break a leg at that TEDx stage.
Will do.
She's the founder of Swim Kids. You can live stream her and other TEDx Atlanta talks this Friday. This is a terrific lineup. You can find out more on our website, gppnews.org. That's all we have time for today. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again tomorrow for more on Second Thought.